This is MuggleCast, the Harry Potter podcast discussing everything about J.K. Rowling's Wizarding World. Welcome to MuggleCast episode 358. I'm Andrew.
I'm Eric.
I'm Micah.
And we are joined by a guest this week. Welcome, Alex, to the show, one of our Slug Club members.
Thanks, guys, for having me. This is great.
Awesome. You said you've been listening for how many years?
13 years. I joined just shortly after y'all started, so...
Awesome, awesome. Well, it's a pleasure to have you on. We appreciate your support. I know you were surprised to get the email. And
I was freaking out when you sent the email.
I'm very glad you're on the show because we have a rare, strong supporter, fan of Harry Potter and the Cursed Child in our midst. So we'll get to that in a second.
Yes.
Let's get the rest of your fandom ID first. How did you get into the Harry Potter series to begin with?
So my aunt gave me books 1 through 4 in the box set as a birthday gift for my 11th birthday. And my mom and I read the first 2 books together. And then after that, I just picked up the 3rd book and ran it from there. After that, I found MuggleNet and MuggleCast and joined the community. And book 5 was kind of that milestone, as that was my first midnight release party that my mom and I went to. So have been with the community ever since.
So there was a 4-book box set, huh? I guess I missed that.
Yeah.
Was it paperback?
No, they were all hardcover.
Oh, well, I bought the paperback box set. That was my first collection.
Yeah, they were all hardcover. They all came in a box and a box set. And when my aunt gave them to me, I was like, "What is this?" Because I had never heard of the series before. And we just got a reading, and I fell in love with it completely.
I see it now. I found one on Biblio.com. It's got the Prisoner of Azkaban cover on one side, at least. Is that right? Is that what you have?
Okay, I don't think I have the box left anymore. Granted, my original copies are, like most fans, you know, falling apart. I don't think I have any of the original book jack covers.
really?
Book jackets. Yeah. We've moved several times and my pages are falling out. So yeah, my original books are sad, but...
No, they're not sad. They're loved. Tested over time. That's the way you got to think of it.
That is true, Mike.
Battle worn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Same thing happened to me, actually, when I was doing the chapter reading for Prisoner of Azkaban last week. I started turning those pages and I heard those cracks and I was like, uh-oh.
Yes.
Wow. Whoops. Time to move. Get a new one.
Well, this is why I'm buying the ebooks now, so I can just read them on the iPad and I don't have to worry about ruining my copies.
It's not the same, though. Come on. You know that.
We talked about the smell recently, didn't we?
Yeah, the smell.
Yeah.
You got to have that smell.
Doesn't have that smell, no. But I got my dog next to me, and he smells, so. Anyway, what are your favorite book and movies?
Favorite book is hands down Prisoner of Azkaban. Movie, it's a tie between either Order of the Phoenix or Deathly Hallows Part 2. And what's interesting about the Order of Phoenix movie is I hate the book. The book is probably my least favorite book, but I think David Yates just did a fantastic job with putting the Harry's emotion, at least, onto the screen. So, I love the movie.
I'm offended by that answer because I don't like the movie but love the book.
Well, but there you go.
What are your Hogwarts and Ilvermorny houses?
Hogwarts house is it's very much an identity crisis. So I grew up thinking I was Gryffindor. When I joined Pottermore during the whole beta section and all of that, and I was a Hufflepuff. And then my girlfriend and I just took the Sorting Hat quiz yet again, and they placed me in Slytherin. So I don't know how. I really don't know how to feel about that.
Yeah, are you okay? Did you enter therapy? What's going on?
Tons of therapy about it, Andrew. It's it's. I don't know what to think about it. I've kind of just resorted. So my mom knitted me a Gryffindor scarf that when I was 8 that I still have, and so I've kind of just resorted to wearing that and calling it good.
Rocking back and forth.
That's right.
Every night before bed.
I think it sounds like you're working your way towards a hat stall.
You know, we're getting close there. We're getting close. But
do you have any cool pieces of Harry Potter merchandise or like a favorite edition that you own?
So what's probably the thing that I love to tout is that I forget how I got it. I think one, I went dumpster diving for it. The other, my grandmother gave it to me. But I have two boxes that Deathly Hallows came in, the Scholastic books. And it says, you know, do not open until July 21st or whenever the books came out. And I've kind of just packed all my memorabilia in those boxes, which is kind of cool. I mean, it to have that last box.
Yeah, those are great boxes. Yeah. A lot of people took those from their bookstore after, like, asked for them after the event and are quite proud of it. They came in, like, about four or five books, I think, because they were such big books, but they hold, like, four or five copies.
No, more than that. Actually, that's so funny you bring that up, Alex, because my parents are on their way out here to Chicago right now to check out my new place, and they're bringing with them my Goblet of Fire, Order of the Phoenix, Half-Blood Prince, and Deathly Hallows boxes.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. I have to give credit to my dad, because like he's like an eBayer, collector, weirdo type of guy. He made me ask for the Goblet of Fire box originally in 2000 down at the Jersey Shore. And ever since then, for the following books, I asked for boxes from the other Midnight releases, including Harry Potter and the Cursed Child.
Hey!
We were in Orlando, and I got one of the boxes, and I broke it apart so it fit in my suitcase, but I did bring it back to Chicago.
That's right. I forgot. You did that. So we got to figure out how many books definitively fit in those boxes. We got to figure it out.
Sure. You can come over.
I think I've put my entire set in one box.
Okay. I'm way off. I
want to say at least 12.
Oh, interesting. Now, granted, but see, they're quite heavy. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, the first couple books are on the smaller end, so that helps. But I think the whole set is in one box.
Alex, what was your Ilvermorny house? Sorry, we skipped over it.
Oh, yeah.
Thunderbird.
Oh, nice.
Thunderbird. Yes. And then, so finally, when you did email me, you said you're a big fan of Cursed Child. So I want to hear about this. Have you seen it or just read it? And why do you love it so much?
I have not seen it. I'm sure looking at the doc, we'll get to the big news of this morning, which we can dive in more. But I have not seen it. I hope to see it on Broadway when hopefully I can get my hands on some tickets. So I've just read it. But when it came out, my mom and I went to the midnight release party and did all that. And I immediately came home and read it just like I've done with every other Harry Potter book. And I loved it. I loved the plot. I loved the twists and turns of it. Yes, we can nitpick. And, you know, there are some things that I disagree with. I completely disagree with the characterization of Cedric. Which I think we've all talked about several times. But like it felt, and this is probably very controversial because J.K. Rowling did not write it, which I recognize, but it felt like Rowling's work. I could sense Rowling on the pages like I did. I have no problem with the characterization of the trio and of Ginny and Draco, you know, these original characters. I love it. Again, I think it's 100% canon. I buy it as the eighth story, and I just can't wait to see it on stage. And hopefully, as Andrew, you have said, I will love it even more on the stage when I see it because it's kind of meant for that media. But I love it. I think it's a great eighth story. So and I was kind of shocked when the fandom was like, oh, we hate it, we just reject it. And I was like, no, this is beautiful.
Well, thanks for joining the show, Alex. We appreciate you coming on today.
Yeah, we have been desperately
kicked out of the fandom now.
No, we've been desperately seeking a super fan of Cursed Child, so we're gonna hire you full time to defend
it's true. We got like 5 or 6 weeks, fellas, before we go and see it ourselves together.
It's good to get the differing perspective, though, as well.
Of course,
it's important.
Yeah. Absolutely. So I'm sure I'll like the actual performance when we do go and see it. But it's definitely interesting to hear somebody who actually enjoyed the book and the plot points of the book for the most part.
Alex mentioned a news story. There was a surprise announcement on Saturday morning. 1,200 tickets to the first preview performances of Part 1 and Part 2, which are happening March 16th and 17th, will be available for $20 per part to buy in person today at the Lyric Theater box office from 8 p.m. Eastern. So this tweet was sent out at 6 a.m. Eastern, and I assume some people ran out and started camping out in line. Micah, are you broadcasting live from the line right now or what? You're kind of close.
I'm actually on my way right now to Times Square to go check it out. So I'll report in about another 20 minutes or so once I'm there and let you know what the line looks like. But
wow, New York is so quiet.
Isn't it amazing? On a Saturday, you know, in the morning on the train, you don't hear a thing.
I will say, you guys, they pushed up. I'm like 90% sure that they pushed up the actual opening day of Cursed Child by like a day or two. I got a text the other day from Andrew Walker, who's going with us to see it. And he said that opening day now is that Sunday, the 22nd. And this was not a date that you could get tickets for when they first opened. And I think that they're doing a U.S. premiere probably with J.K. Rowling, with John Tiffany, Jack Thorne, and all the stars that are going might actually be there on Sunday, not Wednesday, which is the first date you could possibly get, which is the date that we're going.
Right.
So give back our tickets.
That honestly,
I think it's clear that we got to, I mean, we can't go now.
That
we
honestly
switch the date.
Does not surprise me that they weren't selling tickets for the actual opening. Well, so I think technically we're still part of the opening day, but they're doing a media and stars premiere earlier, which makes perfect sense.
It just means J.K. Rowling won't be obstructing my view. She's very tall. But I wanted to be in the same audience at the same time.
No, that makes sense. That makes sense.
That was an extra personal perk, and I don't think it's going to happen, unfortunately.
You had to be there with me. I was at the first preview performance.
That's true. That's true.
This is a great deal, though, for people who may just be in New York next week or are close enough to go and can go out there. They can wait in line. And first, 600 people?
1,200 tickets.
Yeah, so the first 600 people who are in line will get tickets for both parts for $40. I mean, that's a pretty good deal.
Yeah.
That's a steal.
I actually am thinking it's 1,200 people, because isn't the theater like 1,200 seats? I don't know.
I'm looking it up. Lyric Theater.
Well,
and
I'm sure the preview is open for other people besides just these 600.
The Lyric Theater, a.k.a. Foxwoods Theater, holds 1,932 people.
No, but remember they did those renovations and there's going
to
be less seats.
Oh, yeah, to limit to all the obstructed views are gone.
Right.
Yeah. So there's fewer.
I actually will be in New York on March 17th. I fly in that day. Maybe I'll try to make it to the preview night two and hold a Scorbus protest. I need a Scorbus shirt for our nights that were there. Would you two wear one as well in unity with me?
If it were comfortable, if it were made out of the good cotton, none of that chintzy cheap
all
cotton.
Right. It's going to say Scorbus forever, and then it's going to have a picture of them kissing on it. Micah, would you wear that with me?
To stand in solidarity with you?
Yes. Think about it.
I love he asked a follow-up question. Micah
isn't sure if I'm serious or not. It's something I would totally do.
I think he's like half serious.
I needed to dig out my Dumbledore I Always Knew shirt. It's a picture of Dumbledore on it, and it says, I always knew, meaning that he was gay. But the shirt's orange, so I don't like wearing it. Anyway, Speaking of those Harry Potter boxes, I said my parents are coming out here today, and I'm sure I spoke about this on the show at some point, but I had once submitted a letter to this book called We Love Harry Potter, and it was like a fan book. It was an authorized tribute by Sharon Moore. It's basically a bunch of kids' letters published in a book explaining why they love Harry Potter. And so they did like a letter submission, like, let us, you know, submit your letter and we may include it in the book. Well, I wrote my letter in like the summer of 2000 and I got a letter back from them, the Lamp Post Press, who knows if they exist anymore, on dated November 15th, 2000, saying that I was accepted into the sequel, Harry Potter, You're the Best. There is a sequel. to Harry, we love Harry Potter. So anyway, I thought I could read my letter on the show. This is 11-year-old Andrew writing about why he loves Harry Potter.
Are you going to do it in 11-year-old Andrew voice?
Sure. I'll do my best. It's going to be difficult. The Harry Potter books are great because of all the magic and interesting things that J.K. Rowling can think of. My most favorite thing is the every-flavored beans that look cool, because it's like having a bag of jelly beans, but having computer chips, paper, tree branches, or even blood. Whenever Quidditch gets mentioned or played, I always get into it for some reason. I love playing sports, but I don't think that Quidditch is really a sport in the wizard world. I think that is a one-of-a-kind game that everyone just has to play, or they won't be the person with the most skills. I wish that in our world, we could have our own owls, and almost every day you would see them flying around with letters and a few owls carrying one package. I just thought that might be cool in the real world. I think that having magic in our world would make us become a friend of Harry's, Hermione's, and Ron's. Sincerely, Andrew. So Lamppost Press looked at that letter and said, wow, that is so moving, so thoughtful, that we have to publish this in Harry Potter, You're the Best.
It's really touching.
I'm just laughing at, I love playing sports, but I don't think that Quidditch is really a sport in the wizard world. Wow. Wow, 11-year-old Andrew.
Just get into it for real reasons. Yeah, you threw the gauntlet down. I think I also want to see owls traveling back and forth like letters. It's such a pure and innocent, like, it would be cool if the magic was real and we saw it. I don't know about computer-flavored Bertie Bott's every flavored beans, though. Computer chip.
That
flavored.
Was so nerdy me. I used to be so into computers and like opening them up and looking at the computer chips. So that's why that was on my mind probably. Anyway, if you ever happen to see a used copy of Harry Potter, You're the Best, let me know. And maybe I'll ask you to buy it for me and send it to me.
You don't think the Harry Potter collector has a copy of that book?
I should ask him.
You know what? We didn't even ask him about the companion books and side, like what side books he had, like stuff.
Yeah, you know what? That dawned on me this week, actually. I want to know if he has one of the Cuckoo's Callings without J.K. Rowling's name in it.
Oh my God. You know what? I just Googled it, and the first 26 pages are available to preview right now online. I'm going to see if your letter is in it.
Oh, perfect.
Harry Potter, You're the Best, a tribute from fans the world over by Sharon Moore.
Anyway, let's move on to some deeper topics here.
Well, I was going to say also, just really quick, when Eric mentioned owls, that gave me an idea for what shirt I should wear to the opening of Cursed Child.
Yeah. Free the owl.
Yeah, something like owls have rights too.
Owls have rights too. Let the owl fly. Fly, yeah. Owl, fly.
We can come up with a good tagline.
They've already fixed that problem, Micah.
Quick
Not
promo.
To my knowledge.
Quick reminder before we get to our main discussion this week. The 7-7 Challenge is underway over at patreon.com/mugglecast. We've had some people pledge already, so thank you very much to those of you who have. If we hit 777 patrons by the end of March, we will, in May, do a 2-hour live episode filled with call-ins as they come in. We're going to do the holiday movie commentary. We're going to do another Harry Potter movie commentary, and it'll be selected by patrons. And then later in the year, patrons who pledge $5 or more, including Alex, will receive a mug, Ocast mug, the design of which can be seen over at patreon.com/mugglecast or mugglecast.com. And finally, we will do a live stream on video from New York after seeing Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. So those benefits join the plethora of other benefits over at patreon.com/mugglecast live streams, joining the show, bonus MuggleCast installments, chapter readings,
yeah,
monthly Google Hangouts, and so much more.
Can I just say, I'm really excited about these mugs. Like, I'm a collector of mugs, and
oh, good.
I just can't wait to have it in my cabinet. So, yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, they're gonna be great. Eric did a nice job designing them, and the house colors are like a cool twist.
What house color are you gonna get, Alex?
See, that's the question. I don't know. I might just have to go with Gryffindor and call it good, but But no, the pictures and the designs on Patreon look amazing. So I'm really excited.
Awesome. So glad to hear that. And you'll get yours later in the year.
Excellent.
Anyway, let's move on to our discussion this week, which Micah put together for us.
Yeah. So I know that for Bonus MuggleCast last week, we had talked about one of these theories that's been out there for a while. And I forget exactly what was the theory. I'm drawing a complete blank at this point, but either you remember. It was that of invigorating conversation.
The Dursleys' feelings toward
Harry Horcrux.
Thanks, show notes.
Yeah, fake show notes. So on one of the Bonus MuggleCast episodes, we talked about what you may consider to be a crackpot theory, that the Dursleys' feelings towards Harry were actually being magnified and influenced by the presence of a Horcrux. And so this week, though, we decided for the main discussion to go with one that I think has a little bit more legs behind it and could actually, in some cases, be proven to be true. So the main discussion this week centers around whether or not Harry, Snape, and Voldemort were modern-day versions of the three brothers, and if Dumbledore was a representation of death, from the Tales of Beedle the Bard, Andrew's favorite book, and a story that we hear come up in Deathly Hallows. And it's actually a really interesting topic to explore. And kind of before we jump in, interested to get Andrew, Eric, Alex, your kind of initial thoughts, and then I can kind of give some background and thought as to why this has become such a popular theory over the course of the last couple of years since Deathly Hallows has been released.
I like this theory a lot. And I like how with Deathly Hallows, sort of late in the game, we were introduced to this fable within a fable, like book within a book sort of story, with the Tales of Beedle the Bard and the Tale of the Three Brothers being relevant enough to the plot of Book 7. I love that this theory kind of takes that and expands it and is like, well, what if that story is relevant to all 7 Harry Potter books? What if it's relevant to these characters that we've lived and grown with and, isn't in fact an indicator, like saying something even bigger about the world in which we live? So I like the idea that it's just, it takes something that is established in canon and extrapolates it the way all good theories do. From what I've seen, the evidence is pretty compelling too. Mm-hmm.
I love it. I think it's a fantastic theory. I love it so much that I'm currently wearing my MuggleCast No Theory is Safe Three Brothers t-shirt. So I completely buy into this theory.
Good. And the poster or the picture that I used, we also asked this question over on Patreon as the question of the week. It shows Voldemort as the one who died for power. Snape is the one who died for lost love. And Harry as the one who greeted death like an old friend. Stephanie Conlon actually said, all the years of MuggleCast and geeking out, and I can't believe this is my first time seeing this theory. I love it and cannot wait for this discussion. Cool. So I figured we'd start off with a little bit about Dumbledore, right? He is in possession of all three of the Deathly Hallows at some point in the series, much like death is in the story. He has the invisibility cloak early on, which he gives to Harry in Sorcerer's Stone. He has the resurrection stone after destroying the Horcrux, right? Which he gives to Harry tucked inside the snitch that he caught in his first Quidditch game, and that was in Deathly Hallows. And then he is in possession of the Elder Wand, which he inevitably takes to his grave and is later stolen by Voldemort. So we get a sense for that Dumbledore could be a representative figure of death in the series. And so any thoughts there?
I also like the idea of Dumbledore as death, because he in many ways controls and manipulates all of the events in the Harry Potter series, just like death itself does. Like death, like ultimately the only... I was going to say the one thing. There's that saying, the two things in life that are sure, that are certain, are death and taxes, right? So, I mean, I'd like to see a theory that says Dumbledore is actually taxes, but I think Dumbledore as death just fits for me. It's inevitable. Dumbledore is the master manipulator. He's the one to really, I guess, fear. You don't want to get on his bad side. I think that having Dumbledore be representative of some kind of god or universal power kind of fits, just because how much of a heavy hand he has over the events of the series. And if you view the series as like a world, Dumbledore is very much a god of that world.
Are you also saying that Dumbledore, you can't win when you're against Dumbledore in any regard, whether it's politically dueling?
Yeah. Yeah. Like nobody really the only way that Dumbledore can lose is if he allows himself to lose, which is seen by when Snape kills him. And I think part of that is too, like being in possession of the Elder Wand, he really couldn't have been beaten. It was the unbeatable wand, you know, like he gets that from Grindelwald, and I'm assuming he somehow manages to beat Grindelwald, even with Grindelwald having the Elder Wand. That'll be cool to see in a future Fantastic Beasts film. But Dumbledore very much is like a mythic character of death who's in control of life and death. I think that's him. And Dumbledore really discovers the secret of Voldemort's journey, even though Voldemort also kind of dabbles between life and death. Dumbledore kind of spots it. So I think it fits.
Well, and Dumbledore is also involved in pivotal moments in all three of the characters, Snape, Voldemort, and Harry's life. I mean, I think back all the way to when Tom Riddle comes asking for a position at Hogwarts, and that's such a pivotal moment in Tom's and then eventually Voldemort's journey into where he comes, and then Snape coming to Dumbledore seeking for refuge after Voldemort kills the Potters, and of course, I mean, Dumbledore and Harry's journey is completely tied together throughout the seven books. So Dumbledore has his hands in, I mean, going back to what you were saying, Eric, of being the manipulator, Dumbledore has his hands in pivotal moments in all three of the characters' journeys.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a very good point. And so speaking of Voldemort, like we're taking a closer look at him and seeing him as the one who died for power, that would parallel with Antioch Peverell, who wanted the Elder Wand, right? Voldemort is somebody who is constantly trying to find a way to defy death and is extremely power hungry, much like the first brother that we hear about in the story. You know, all you have to do is reference the Horcruxes, right? He's looking for a way to kind of hold on to immortality. His desire for power and to some extent his arrogance is ultimately his undoing.
Absolutely.
If you look at the two quotes, one from Beetle the Bard and then one from Deathly Hallows, I think they mirror each other very closely. So the first brother from Beetle the Bard or the Tale of the Three Brothers, it says, "Leaving his enemy dead upon the floor, the oldest brother proceeded to an inn where he boasted loudly of the powerful wand he had snatched from death himself, and of how it made him invincible." And then if you look at the quote, Voldemort and Harry are, you know, confronting each other in Deathly Hallows, it says, "But I got there ahead of you, little boy. I reached the wand before you could get your hands upon it. I understood the truth before you caught up. I killed Severus Snape 3 hours ago, and the Elder Wand, the Death Stick, the Wand of Destiny is truly mine. Dumbledore's last plan went wrong, Harry Potter." So it's very condescending, right? Much like the first brother was boasting about how he was able to take down this other person. So I do see a lot of parallels there.
Yeah. And in this situation, Voldemort is finally at what he believes is his point of conquering. He believes he's going to take down Harry Potter. So he has this boastful attitude in light of that.
To be killed, which is fitting with the story. I mean, the elder wand toting brother gets killed and doesn't succeed.
You should have read Beetle the Bard to find out what was going to happen to him.
Clearly, power isn't everything.
Right, right. And one thing that we hear consistently throughout the course of the Potter series is that the only person that Voldemort ever feared was Dumbledore. And if Dumbledore is death, which Voldemort also fears, that would make a whole lot of sense.
Wow. I like it.
The next one, I kind of struggled with this one. This is the more difficult, I think, of the three with Snape.
We'll make
and
it
the
work.
Resurrection Stone.
Let's do it. Let's make it work.
I think we can. I can say
the connection.
There's some stuff.
And the tie to Cadmus Peverell. So the key piece here, and one thing to mention is later on, there are a lot of people who feel as if Dumbledore fits better with this particular connection than Snape does. And I think there's evidence for that as well. But I think kind of along the lines of what we've already spoken about, Dumbledore really fits well with death. So I'm hesitant to pull him from that and place him in this category, but we can talk about both. So much like the second brother in the Tale of the Three Brothers, Snape longs to see a lost love in Lily Potter, right? And there's no evidence to really state that he would do anything to bring her back to life, at least not that I saw. But there is that moment, like once he sees her again and he sees her through Harry's eyes in Deathly Hallows, he's able to die. He's able to move on. Again, this one is a little bit more challenging in my mind to kind of make those connections. Also, because if you're looking at Voldemort and you're looking at Harry, which we will just after this, they do have direct connections going back to the Peverils. They're related. They're distant relatives. And there's no evidence that Snape is related. So, again, help me make this argument. That's what I'm saying.
Cool. I think it has to do with possessive love and the kind of love that Snape really has for Lily, not just after she dies, but while she's alive as well. I think that, you know, much like the second brother who wanted to humiliate death further by asking for something that would give him the power to recall, you know, vanquished loved ones from death. I think that Snape loses Lily before she dies, and he is very angry and he doesn't really reach a resolution over it. And I think that, you know, he feels as though a part of him is maybe owed or is still behaving as though it's not his own fault that she's not with him.
Yeah, I think you could argue that Snape wishes he could resurrect Lily, right?
In some ways he has, by his own Patronus, becoming the Doe, and definitely through Harry's, you know, his connection with Harry and Harry's eyes, Lily is in some ways living on. And the fact that Snape, despite how much of a D-I-C-K he is to Harry as a teacher, there is something about that connection that still haunts him. I think the fact that Snape is a very haunted person in the way that the second brother was, you know, maybe visibly haunted by after what he had done. Presumably he succeeds in bringing back the ghost or shadow. You know, we learn more about what exactly it is in the Forest Again scene, but he succeeds in bringing back his loved one, but she doesn't belong there. And it's kind of, he kills himself rather than like realizing what he's done. And I think Snape sacrifices himself for the good or for love, but he's very similarly haunted, I want to say, by what could have been, by a loved one that he had. He's very much not moving on and trying to see, you know, who else is out there. He's very stuck and hung up over this girl that he once loved, just like the second brother.
Well, and even in his promise to Dumbledore of looking after Harry, I mean, we get this sense that, I mean, yes, we don't have anything in the books that says he wants to bring Lily back, but Lily is a manifestation in Harry, and Snape promises to Dumbledore that he will do everything he can to protect Harry. And then, I mean, we see that all throughout the books, and especially in Deathly Hallows with the Patronus bringing the sword to Harry and all of that. So, I mean, this Snape is always longing for Lily, and it manifests through Harry's journey to killing Voldemort.
All right. I like those arguments.
Yeah. But let's talk about Dumbledore in that role real quickly.
Yeah, because I think the case for Dumbledore in many ways is just as strong, if not stronger, than the one for Snape. So, you know, there are theories out there that Dumbledore represents the second brother, who is, as we mentioned, he was given the Resurrection Stone and he killed himself after trying to bring back his lost love. In this case, I think that lost love would represent his sister, Ariana, right? And if you go back to the information that we have from Half-Blood Prince, Dumbledore's blackened hand right? It's the result of this moment of weakness when a lot of people think he likely contemplated bringing back his sister instead of immediately going ahead and destroying the Horcrux, right? So he has the ring in which this stone rests, and we know that he puts it on. So that would very much align itself with this idea of him trying to bring back a lost loved one, much like the second brother did. And he does pay for it with his life, right? It's safe to think that, and we know we have that moment in the flashback where Snape is analyzing his hand, he eventually would have died. So do you feel like this theory lends itself more credibility than the one about Snape?
I don't know that anybody replaces death if Dumbledore is not occupying that spot. If Dumbledore is in this spot instead, then nobody is death. Death is just a thing. Because I wouldn't argue that Snape is death. But I think it's possible that Dumbledore could be the Resurrection Stone. But then nobody is death. Death is just death.
Or maybe Dumbledore is all three brothers.
Well, it's funny that you say that, because Megan Poehler on Patreon had the same theory. And she said, I see how the three brothers, I see how the three represent the brothers, but I don't get how Dumbledore represents death. I think Dumbledore himself is like the three brothers at different times in his life. In his youth, he wanted power and to travel the world. After the death of his sister, he regretted his actions and would have done anything to get them back. And as he got older, he learned to accept death and treated it like the next great adventure.
I will say, I hope our discussion at the top of this discussion about Dumbledore being death has convinced you or helped to do so. Because I do think Dumbledore firmly fits in the death category. He's the master of everything. He's the one to be feared. He's, you know, all of that. And him as the Resurrection, I can see it. He is really regretful of his past actions in the way that Snape, you know, could be said to be too. So I do agree it could go either way on the Resurrection Stone thing.
Right.
Yeah. I just kind of like ignoring Dumbledore as the Resurrection Stone, just because I'd rather Snape be there.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk about Harry and being the third brother. And, you know, he is a descendant of Ignotus Peverell. And much like the third brother in the story, whether directly or indirectly, intentional or unintentional, Harry does evade death throughout the course of the series, right?
Multiple times.
Many times, yes.
Even when he's not trying, he could do it with his eyes closed.
And much like the third brother, when the time comes, he meets death as an old friend. But it's only when he's ready to do so, and think back to that moment in the Forbidden Forest, and then eventually at King's Cross, or what he believes in his mind to be King's Cross, when he meets death, quote-unquote Dumbledore.
Yeah, his old friend.
His
Dumbledore.
Old friend, yeah.
Dumbledore is death, everybody.
Yeah, and I mean, that was something I wanted to bring up earlier when we were discussing Dumbledore as death. I mean, he's literally in the platform between life and death.
Quote-unquote afterlife.
He is
scene.
Sort of the death train in that scene. Come with death Dumbledore, train. And you're dead, because I am death.
Right. And I pulled the two quotes, kind of similar to what we did for Voldemort, one from Beedle the Bard and one from Deathly Hallows. So from Beedle the Bard, it says, "It was only when he had attained a great age that the youngest brother finally took off the cloak of invisibility and gave it to his son. And then he greeted death as an old friend and went with him gladly, as equals, and as equals they departed this life." In Deathly Hallows, it says, "His hands were sweating as he pulled off the invisibility cloak and stuffed it beneath his robes with his wand. He did not want to be tempted to fight." So he's willingly giving himself up at this point to Voldemort. And, you know, there are a lot of parallels here, and I think it fits very nicely.
I always wondered why he stored the invisibility cloak in his robes at that point. Like, somebody's going to have to loot his corpse to get it back. Like, I just thought that, like, just leave it in the forest, man. Just, like, don't make, you know, like, yeah, just
he wants
throw it,
it
down.
He wants it with them when he's departing. I think that's the right way to do it.
And just a notch for Cursed Child as canon, we see Harry give the cloak to his son in Cursed Child. So it fits with exactly what the third brother did in Beedle the Bard.
It certainly does help that Harry is presumably, I mean, we know that he's directly descended from the third brother.
Yeah.
That makes the case for him being the third brother really strong to begin with. And then all the examples that Micah has of him fleeing death and his eventual self-sacrifice.
Right.
This is the strongest case, I think.
I think the Voldemort and the Harry cases are very strong. As we've talked about, I think the Snape one is a little, it's the weaker of the three. There's not as much solid evidence. And if we knew about Snape and his history and a little bit more, obviously we know about his parents, but even going back further, it would help. As you mentioned, Eric, that Harry is related to the third brother. Voldemort is related through the Gaunts to the second brother. There's not a whole lot of connection there. I don't necessarily see between Voldemort and the second brother, more so the first. But
yeah, well, I mean, the second brother too breaks the rules, right? He asks to recall loved ones, like people who've already died. He wants back. That's against the rules of nature. It's against the rules of the world. And Snape often breaks the rules of what a teacher should be. Again, thinly kind of excused there, but I think that Snape really breaks the mold. He breaks the mold of what a spy should be. He breaks the mold of what a teacher should be. He is obsessed with this lost love. I really strongly believe it does fit the second brother, but perhaps there might be an editorial on MuggleNet or somewhere where it explains a little bit better how he would fit than what we're achieving right now.
Yeah.
I don't think he would. I think so. While he's madly in love with Lily, and love can make somebody go crazy and not think straight, I think he was still wise enough to realize that bringing her back was just not a possibility for a variety of reasons. One of which is that that would just be such a shocking thing to do. Possibly even tempt Voldemort to kill her again, or one of his followers to kill her. I think it would be, I would think it would put her in a dangerous position.
Thinking about this, I reminding myself that I have to watch Corpse Bride. I've never seen it, you know, thinking of Lily coming back. But I think, again, Lily lives on through Snape's Patronus, and that's how he's managed to come to terms with. Still, he still needs her around, right? Every time he has her around, he just needs to conjure a Patronus to kind of be at peace, or at, you know, in her, what he feels would be like her presence.
Well, even Alex mentioned, he lives on through, or she lives on through Harry, and sort of that final moment for Snape when he says, "Look at me," you know, that's, he's looking at Lily. He's not looking at Harry.
Yeah. Way to use Harry for his eyes, jerk.
So just a few other things as we kind of wrap up this discussion. J.K. Rowling did like this fan theory of Dumbledore representing death back in 2015. It was on her Twitter, which is reliable, not reliable, depending on who you talk to. But
it is now, or back in 2015, it was the place to be on the internet.
It was the place to be.
Simpler times in her Twitter
account. Kind of like Hagrid's.
Yeah.
What did she say exactly? She said, "Dumbledore is death. It's a beautiful theory, and it fits."
Yeah, somebody, Abby OJ asked her, "What's your favorite fan theory?"
Yeah, and that's particularly interesting because, like, somebody didn't link her to it, and then she was like, "Oh, yeah, that's cool." She actually has this theory in her head. Like, she remembered it. She read it at a certain point, and it stuck with her. So I think that's pretty cool.
100%.
And adds to the weight of the theory being legit.
Definitely. And what do you guys think about, you know, again, as Dumbledore, this representation of death? He is inevitably responsible for the deaths of Voldemort, Snape, and Harry, right? You can trace it back to him, given that he was the one who came up with this master plan. So that Dumbledore
did it again.
J.K. Rowling's the last part of this tweet, though, after she says it's a beautiful theory, she says, "And it fits." I mean, you don't need anybody else to sign on board to your fan theory if J.K. Rowling says it fits.
Right.
I'm pretty excited. Congrats, guys. We did it.
Did we ever consider these possibilities after reading Deathly Hallows? It's possible we talked about them on another podcast, but did...
I don't think so, because...
We're not that smart.
Well, we're not that smart. And the Snape one, it's not a perfect match. Like, I doubt J.K. Rowling would be like, "Yeah, the Snape as the resurrection stone, like the second brother, it fits."
Right.
Unless somebody, we need to tweet J.K. Rowling. Maybe that'll be... I'm going to do a new segment where we just... Oh, my Alexa got activated.
Did she ever get back to you on...
No. I'm going to try again this week.
What did you? I just saw a tweet from MuggleCast to Joe, and it was like, "You up or something ridiculous?"
No. Last week, I asked her about the some theory. This week, I'm going to tweet: do you like the Snape is the second brother / Resurrection Stone theory? Just tweeted from MuggleCast.
I think you asked about flu shots.
Oh yeah, do wizards get flu shots?
You're just going to troll her now, aren't you?
60 likes, no responses from her though.
We're going to need a black. Mantled, blacklisted.
Just something that I just was thinking about when talking about Rowling liking this theory. Rowling often cites that she is Dumbledore or has Dumbledore connections. So what do you think of Rowling being Dumbledore and then Rowling being not death? I mean, never call Rowling that, but well, that's what I'm saying. You know, the master manipulator of the series.
I mean, yeah, absolutely. She is in charge of who lived and who died. Everybody get on her shit about Hedwig and Fred and, you know, all of those people. She apologizes for those deaths. I mean, she absolutely is death in Harry Potter.
Are
to be
you
honest.
Trying to wedge J.K. Rowling into canon?
No, maybe, you know, Stephen King did it. Maybe if Dumbledore is the Resurrection Stone, then J.K. Rowling is death.
There it is.
Which I don't think that could be argued.
We're going to get to some Patreon responses to this discussion, but we have an advertiser this week. This week's episode of MuggleCast is brought to you by RX Bar. They are a company that makes honest, delicious whole food protein bars. And you might be wondering, what does whole food even mean? What are you talking about, Andrew? Their bars are made with 100% whole ingredients. RX Bar realized that real food ingredients actually taste really good. You can taste the cacao, the real fruit, the spices, like sea salt, and any RX bar you're enjoying. And the secret lies in the ingredients. They all got egg whites for protein, dates to bind, and nuts for texture. It's that simple. Whether you like sweet or savory, chocolate or fruit flavors, there's an RX bar for you. They come in 11 delicious flavor varieties. My personal favorite is the chocolate sea salt. They're chewy, and they're large enough that they feel like a substantial mini meal. They're great for breakfast on the go, snack at the office, for a hike, for a bike ride, or what I use them for, a pre or post-workout snack. And they're great for workouts because they have 12 grams of protein in them. I actually came across a bar of the chocolate sea salt once the other day at Target, and I picked them up real quick. I'm low-key addicted to them. I really like them. Please introduce yourself to them by picking up the chocolate sea salt ones. They're also at Starbucks right at the register, which is really... It's hard for me to avoid them when they're staring right at me when I'm picking up a Starbucks coffee. But you can get them online as well. For 25% off your first order, visit rxbar.com/MuggleCast and enter promo code MuggleCast at checkout. You'll get 25% off your first order and get a little box of them. I have a little box and probably eat one after the show. I do like a pre-podcasting snack. Eric and Micah, do you indulge in pre-podcast snacks?
Yes, but my Rice Krispies treats ran out.
Oh. I'm guessing those are not full of whole food ingredients.
No.
A little more processed.
No. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, for me, I mean, we are pretty early in the morning, so some coffee.
Yeah.
But this sounds like a very good substitute for that and a healthier one as well.
RX Bar and coffee. That's the dream.
You'll be set for the day.
No, seriously, because like chocolate and coffee, it's actually really good.
Good to know.
rxbar.com/MuggleCast and promo code MuggleCast. So let's get to those Patreon responses. What did our listeners have to say about this theory?
So they have some pretty interesting thoughts as well. Amy Hill said, some of the similarities seem a little too strong to be purely coincidental, but I don't think it was meant to be a perfect parallel. Both Harry and Voldemort are descendants of the Peverils, so it's not surprising that Rowling might have included some similarities in them. We don't know enough about Snape's heritage to see a connection there. It's a really neat theory, and I think there are intentional references or parallels, but I don't think we can say for sure that this exact theory was what played out. I think it especially gets weak when you get to Dumbledore's death. See, I think it actually gets stronger when you get to Dumbledore's
death. Yeah, again, see our this episode discussion. I hope that their mind has changed.
And I think... real quick, J.K. Rowling saying that's your favorite theory implies that she wasn't thinking about this while writing. Otherwise, I think she may have said, like, I once read this theory, and yeah, actually, I was thinking about that.
Jenny Brennan, I really want that picture as a poster. I think this makes a lot of sense. It also explains why Dumbledore had so much sympathy for Snape, because, as we know, the ring tempted him over any of the other objects. Irvin said, I love this theory to pieces. I think it's one of the more genius revelations from the fandom since Deathly Hallows was released. In particular, it strikes me that Dumbledore is instrumental in giving the three brothers the Hallows. Voldemort took the wand from Dumbledore's corpse. He bypassed the ring, but Dumbledore gave Snape what Snape considered a poor imitation of Lily, her son, who looks just like James. And of course, he gives Harry the cloak.
I love the idea of Harry as a poor imitation of Lily that Dumbledore gives to Snape. I like that a lot.
It's a little rough, but all right.
Well, I mean, by appointing Snape a teacher, he gives him access to Harry.
True.
Who is a cheap knockoff of Lily.
Allie F., I believe that she doesn't make parallels just to make parallels. Voldemort's ultimate quest was to defy death in whatever means he can. We know that the first brother tries to defy death and gets taken simply due to his arrogance, not unlike Tom. Snape, with his undying love for Lily, has the second brother matched as well. He makes the ultimate sacrifice for Lily, taking care of her son, while playing both sides. His final request was to be looked at by Lily through Harry's eyes, as the second brother ultimately saw his true love one last time, before death took him as well. I think death has always been looking for Harry and feels cheated by Tom's inability to make it so. He's like Ignotus in that he wants to welcome death as a friend, which he does in the forest. And though Tom once again fails to achieve it, and that Harry can welcome death as an old friend. Yeah, I think Allie does a really good job there of breaking down the three and giving explanations, a lot of which we spoke about in the discussion earlier.
Absolutely.
She seems a little more confident about the Snape angle.
She does. Yeah, she gave much better explanation. I should have just stolen hers and given her credit for it. But there were some responses too that were just pretty straightforward. Nah, I'm good. I don't need to explore that theory. That's actually what one of them said. But I wanted a little bit more substance there as to why they didn't think the theory was actually, you know, legit before including it in the show. But if there are people out there that are listening or over on Patreon that completely disagree with this theory and can item by item kind of debunk it, definitely send in your thoughts. We'll include them on the next episode.
Okie dokie. We have a couple of voicemails, and then we'll get over to a couple of emails.
Hi, this is Selena, a big fan. I've been listening since about 2006. Anyways, I was just calling after listening to your really interesting conversation about potions this week. And I was wondering what your thoughts were on maybe providing government regulation for some of the potions, particularly with like love potions and amortentia and things like that, especially in the wake of like the Me Too movement and how we're trying to raise awareness for sexual harassment and stuff in the workplace and in like real life, things like that. These love potions are essentially like magic roofies. So I'm wondering if maybe in the wake of that, some wizards in the government might be willing to offer opportunities to provide kind of more government regulation on that. Also, Polyjuice Potion. Like, it is so easy to steal someone's identity. Like, you would think that that's a controlled substance, but apparently Hermione can just make it in a bathroom. I know that she stole a lot of supplies from Snape, and she wasn't technically supposed to get the book because it was in the restriction section, but she was 12, and she had relatively easy access to all of those ingredients to make, like, literal identity theft potion. Anyways, that's all. Just wondered what you thought about that. Thanks. Bye.
It's a great question. I think, to both points, maybe there hasn't been government regulation, or it hasn't gotten more difficult for students to be able to do it because it hasn't really gotten out of control. Nobody's taken advantage of it, hopefully.
Yet. Right. I think about amortentia and how you can get it and in various strengths. I think Fred and George probably perfected it, but like you can just go to Diagon Alley, walk into the shop. Is it technically for the 18 or older or 17 and older wizards? Isn't there a section in Fred and George's shop that has like it's not an age line, but it's like, is a different, am I remembering correctly that it's in a different area love potions versus the other ones.
I don't recall seeing that at the theme park, so I do not know.
Yeah, right. Either way, everybody gets in that needs to. So, yeah, I think it's definitely an opportunity for improvement, room for improvement on the government's part. And as far as Polyjuice Potion, like, the only thing I can say to that is it takes like a month to brew. Like, it takes a substantial time investment, which is why maybe it's not as protected. Like, I don't know. Surely there's a shop where you can just buy it off the shelf. But we don't see that as much as we see the Amortentia being, you know, store-bought and readily available. I think both substances should be controlled, especially as a result of, you know, what this caller points out is, you know, amounts to some pretty serious offenses, identity theft and rape or coerced, you know, sexual stuff. So I think it's absolutely incredibly important and relevant. And I think if the Wizarding World were as contemporary as our Muggle world, they would probably be doing these sorts of things right now.
Yeah, it's sort of like when there are issues going on in the real world, we try to make changes to prevent them from happening again, i.e. gun control. If things were getting out of control in the wizard world in regards to potions and, you know, things like Polyjuice and Amortentia, then I think they would make some changes then. Interesting question, though. Obviously, J.K. Rowling never really wrote about them getting out of control. And you look at Hermione and her drive to create the Polyjuice Potion. It looks like it took quite a bit of effort going into the restriction section and whatnot. So it probably wasn't more difficult because kids often didn't do it because why would they? It sounds like a pain in the butt. I got enough to do. Here's our next voicemail.
Hi, my name is Audra. I'm calling from the Chicago area in Illinois. And I was listening to your most recent episode called Potions, and I noticed something that wasn't quite correct. You mentioned that the potion that Albus Dumbledore takes in Book 6 when they are retrieving the Horcrux from the cave, that that potion was also drank by a creature when Regulus Black went to retrieve the locket. One of the things they talked about was that how Regulus Black actually refused to let creature drink the potion and drank it himself. And that was one of the things that made him more memorable and made Creature more devoted to him. So that's just what I wanted to let you know while I was listening, that Creature did not, in fact, drink that potion. Thanks. Have a great day.
All right.
What have we done?
Little correction there. Just wanted to get that in because I think a couple of people had mentioned that.
That's huge.
That's a good point. And I think I was the one who initially said, or at least started that discussion about Creature. So clearly I need to go back and reread Half-Blood Prince.
Yes, you do, to look at that painful death scene.
Micah, why didn't you remember my death scene? Ah! Well, it would probably be Deathly Hallows, not Half-Blood Prince.
Sorry, but painful scene, I meant. Anywho, a couple more emails here. This is from Brooke. Brooke, hi, MuggleCast. While rereading Prisoner of Azkaban, I started thinking about Boggarts and how they transform into fears. I was thinking that how Boggarts transform into what people fear most. What would happen if someone feared Boggarts? What would happen to the Boggarts? I just wanted to run the theory with you guys. By the way, I love your shows. Boggarts, Boggarts, Boggarts. I think the Boggart would just implode. Or it wouldn't change at all.
I really want to know what a Boggart really looks like.
Do people... I guess the presumption is that nobody's worst fear is a Boggart. Because why would it be? Is your worst fear a Boggart? Because it'll turn into your worst fear. But if the worst fear is the Boggart,
yeah, I think there must be a way of elaborately setting up like a series of mirrors. I was going to say like a video camera, but magic items ruin electronics. But there has to be a way now to like capture a Boggart in its true form. It would probably involve like an infinity mirror and, you know, something kind of creepy. Like,
But doesn't it kind of tie to what Lupin tells Harry about? This is very wise because what you fear most is fear itself. And isn't that what a Boggart manifests itself into? So it could just be a Dementor. Although, I mean, maybe that's a little too specific to Harry, but I don't know. How do you know what a Boggart? I don't know that you know enough of what a Boggart actually looks like to fear it, right? It's a manifestation of what you ultimately fear. I just don't see people fearing Boggarts themselves.
Katie, who's listening live right now on Patreon, says it would probably turn into your imagination's version of a Boggart. That's a good point.
That is a good point.
For next week's episode, our homework is to draw what we imagine a Boggart looks like. I kind of imagine them like a spiky little thing. Because in Prisoner of Azkaban, the movie, it's like a like when it's transitioning, it's like a ball of blackness, right?
Yeah.
All right, one more email here about games. I had a couple questions about the Harry Potter games, past, present, and future. Do you know when the Wizards Unite and other mobile games are to be released? Have you played Cards Against Muggles or the Battle of Hogwarts card game? I was thinking about buying it, but wasn't sure how they were. I wanted to ask the panel here about the card games in particular. Has anyone played Cards Against Muggles or the Battle of Hogwarts card game?
I've played Cards Against Muggles.
Yes. Yeah, as have I with you.
I have not played either of these games, so.
I have not played the Hogwarts card game. I don't know. It just doesn't totally seem like something I would be into. I'm not really into card games.
As far as there was a, there's a Harry Potter Trivial Pursuit that's just year one, which is pretty cool. It's like for some, like it's Sorcerer's Stone Trivial Pursuit. Totally unbelievable. And it's really good. I played that. And I think as far as the video games, I've played many of them, at least up to year five in the EA games, like the book to movie adaptations. Of course, the first two were actually more book than movie, which is great. They're really solid. And then, of course, the Lego games and Harry Potter Quidditch World Cup, which is one of the best games ever made.
Yeah, for me, and I've said this probably too many times on the show already, video game wise, the Lego games stand out beyond any of the others that exist. They're just fun to play, and you know, I don't think there's another game that allows you to even come close to being the number of characters that this game does. I mean, pretty much any character you can possibly think of in the Harry Potter series, you can play as in the Lego games. You know, obviously only certain characters are available for years 1 to 4 and then 5 to 7, but I can't recommend those games enough. So if you're looking for video games to play in the interim until these mobile games are released, definitely check out the Lego games.
Yeah, and there is a combined, you can get both Lego Harry Potter games on one PlayStation 4 disc now. I just picked this up at GameStop recently. It was like $30 for Harry Potter Lego, the collection. So it's really, really good stuff.
This email was from Emily, by the way. I actually have a little scoop about one of the forthcoming Harry Potter mobile games somebody told me about the other day. I'm not going to share what it is, but I'm just going to say it's below the Harry Potter series, and they should be embarrassed that they're making this game and that it's apparently coming out.
Whoa. Wow. Okay, fighting words.
We'll complain about it whenever it comes out later this year.
It's another game, or it's one of the ones we've already spoken
about?
No,
it's another game, but like, it's dumb.
Okay.
We're going to roll our eyes. It's almost time for Quizzitch, but we have one more sponsor this week, NBC's Rise. On March 13th, the lives of 7 kids are about to change. From the network that brings you This Is Us comes the next great drama, Rise. From the producer of the acclaimed Broadway musical Hamilton and the producer of Friday Night Lights and Parenthood, it's an amazing new drama inspired by a true story. When a dedicated teacher takes over a high school's failing theater department, he'll change the lives of 7 kids and transform a town. The critics rave that Rise promises gut-wrenching emotion and human drama and Glee-style musical euphoria. Entertainment Tonight says, "We haven't been this instantly smitten with the drama since we watched This Is Us." Rise stars Josh Radnor, Rosie Perez, and the voice of Moana, Ali'i Carvalho. USA Today raves, "Ali'i Carvalho steals the spotlight." You'll see why Variety calls Rise a hit in the making. So don't miss the premiere of Rise after an all-new episode of the season finale of America's number one drama, This Is Us, Tuesday, March 13th on NBC. Also, my brother's birthday. Don't miss my brother's birthday and the premiere of Rise, March 13th.
How is Ryan? How's he doing?
He's fine. He's on his way out here, too, with my Harry Potter boxes.
Oh, I love it.
All right, let's play some Quizzitch.
All right. Well, we actually have a slight correction. Super funny. We have some winners of last week's question, but it turns out I was wrong in looking it up. The question was, who are the members of the advanced guard who come and grab Harry from Privet Drive and take him to Grimmauld Place? I suggested that there were 7 members of the advanced guard, which is actually what Google turned up, side eyes at Google. However, there were, in fact, 9 members. And we did get some winners of this Quizzitch question. As always, people who want to answer this question, please send it to us via Twitter. But as Sean Brady, at Brady Bunchkin, says on Twitter, there are actually 9 members of the Advance Guard. They are Remus Lupin, Alistair Moody, Nymphadora Tonks, Kingsley Shacklebolt, Elpheus Dodge, Daedalus Diggle, Emmeline Vance, Sturgis Podmore, and Hestia Jones. Hashtag Quizzitch. So that is the correct answer. I've double-checked and actually read the chapter of the book, The Advance Guard, since. Sean Brady, Christy P., and Chloe Ewer at Levy Theater all got the correct answer of Quizzitch. Thank you all for correcting me. I wonder why there were 9 and not 7, but, you know, isn't 7 the most magically powerful number?
Well,
and yeah,
I actually agree that it should have been the smaller number, because I read this chapter, I'm working through Order of the Phoenix now, recently, and I was like, Emmeline Vance, Hestia Jones, who are these people?
Well, that's, I think they make an appearance, they just don't have much dialogue, right? Like, they show up to, but they're part of the guard that shows up. It's just we don't
know. No, I understand that, but they're irrelevant, so don't even waste the pen on
this
the paper.
This is their shining moment. They're picking Harry up.
They, I know.
Yeah, but anyway, thank you for the correction and also submitting your answers to us via Twitter. Next week's question, this is a quickie, but it's from Deathly Hallows in light of our recent Deathly Hallows discussion. What is the name of the other goblin besides Griphook that Harry encounters in the forest with the Potter Watch crew? Griphook has a buddy. And what is that buddy's name? Okay. And I don't know that they're buddies, but they are fellow goblins. So okay. That's next week's question. Submit your answers over Twitter.
What are you plugging here?
I'm plugging, I have a new, so I'm producing a podcast that's brand new. Right before we close, just wanted to mention it. Actually, it's pretty cool that the recent voicemail mentioned the Time's Up and Me Too movement. The podcast that I'm now producing and I'm the sole editor of is called HR Unconfidential. And it's from two HR managers in the Chicagoland area who are going to be talking about, you know, talking weekly about topics that are relevant to HR, the workplace. If you are, you know, if you have a job, if you're in the workplace, or if you work in HR, but even if you don't, this podcast is for you. And episode 1 of HR Unconfidential is actually specifically on the Me Too and Time's Up movement and sexual harassment in the workplace. So it's going to be a really good podcast. The ladies, Gina and Taria, are very good at what they do. They've been doing it for like 25, 30 years. And if you're looking for a new podcast or a podcast that will make you think or maybe help you out at the workplace with different issues, their podcast will cover it.
Interesting.
So check it out. It's over on SoundCloud, but you can also find it on iTunes. HR Unconfidential is its name. And like I said, I'm editing all the apps for them. And it's a really good podcast. And the one that's coming up next Thursday is going to be an episode on HR horror stories, like the absolute worst things they've had to deal with as managers. And it's going to be a hilarious episode.
Sounds like a good idea for a show. Don't forget our website, mugglecast.com, where you can find everything you need about this show, including a link to our Patreon, where you can pledge for the 777 challenge to get extra benefits added to our summer plans and get a slew of instant benefits like bonus MuggleCasts, another of which we are about to record after this episode. What are we going to talk about in our next bonus MuggleCast, Mike R.?
So we're just going to continue on with those crackpot theories, and this one, it's a bit of a stretch, but we're going to debate it like it's a real topic.
Like it's 2007.
That's right, yeah. And it's about Crookshanks and whether or not he belonged to the Potters.
All right, thank you everybody for listening, and Alex, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, this was amazing.
Awesome. Yeah, I hope you had a great time. Where are you in the country, by the way?
I am currently in Louisville, Kentucky, in grad school.
Oh, very cool. Good for you. And thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time. I'm Andrew.
I'm Eric.
I'm Micah.
And I'm Alex.
Goodbye.